Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and look into the standoff between Russia and the Ukraine in terms of energy being used as a weapon by Russia to squeeze Ukraine, and the U.S. in turn retaliating by ramping up exports of natural gas to Ukraine and the EU. Michael Clare, a Five College Professor of Peace and World Security and author of Blood and Oil and The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources, joins us to discuss his article at The Nation, Petromachismo, and how much the U.S. fracking boom has affected geopolitics. Then we will discuss the ramifications of the upcoming referendum in Crimea that will effectively place the Ukrainian territory just occupied by Russian forces under the Kremlin's control. John Quigley, who was a research scholar at Moscow University and has dealt with conflicts between Russia and Ukraine after the breakup of the USSR on behalf of the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe, joins us to discuss his article at the Cambridge Journal for International and Comparative Law, Finding a Way Forward for Crimea. Then finally, we'll examine the shameful vote in the U.S. Senate in which 7 Democratic senators joined the Republicans in blocking the nomination of Debo Adegbole to be Assistant Attorney General for the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. Will Bunch, an award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, joins us to discuss the role of Pennsylvania's senators, including the Democrat Senator Bob Casey, in scuttling Obama's appointment because his nominee represented a client considered a cop killer in Pennsylvania, thus establishing a dangerous precedent that makes attorneys responsible for the acts of the clients they are sworn to defend. And joining us now is Michael Clare, a Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His books include Blood and Oil and most recently The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. He has an article at The Nation, Petromachismo. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Clare.
My pleasure, always.
And the Russians have used the natural gas lever as a weapon against Ukraine in the past. The pipeline goes from Russia through Ukraine into Europe, and to punish Ukraine, they've turned it off, and it had obviously had adverse consequences for Europe. But now they're threatening to up the price. They've been giving the prior to this invasion of Crimea, they've been giving Ukraine a break on the price, but now they're saying they want to increase the price. And, of course, this is a country that's, for all intents and purposes, bankrupt. So it's pretty clear that gas is being used as a weapon. And now there's talk on the American side of using American gas from the fracking boom as a counterweapon. Is that your understanding?
Yes, but it's, of course, everything in life is complicated, and this story is more complicated than that. Gazprom, the Russian state natural gas monopoly, has had close ties over the years with the Ukrainian natural gas company and energy company, and there's been a lot of collusion there. So there's been a back and forth between Moscow and Kiev over natural gas prices, and there's a lot of collusion, a lot of corruption. A lot of people have gotten oligarchs, as they're called, in both Russia and in Ukraine, have gotten very rich. So one of the issues that has triggered the current crisis is the EU made an offer, a substantial offer to former President Yanukovych to open Ukraine to the EU or to closer ties with the EU. Part of that deal was that Ukraine would have to end this cozy relationship with Gazprom and institute greater transparency, greater openness in its energy operations. And it's this This was highly favored by the people who revolted against Yanukovych, but that's what forced him to reject it under pressure from Moscow. So natural gas has been central to the crisis from the very beginning.
So how quickly then could the U.S. replace these markets? Because obviously if Russia retaliates in any way by cutting, as they've done in the past, by cutting off gas to Ukraine, because the pipeline goes on to Europe, which is their main market, they are, you know, cutting off their nose to spite their face. So how quickly could the West and particularly the U.S. come up with an alternative for, say, Ukraine, which depends upon, I think, 60% of its energy comes from Russia?
I don't see how this is feasible in any immediate conceivable time horizon. The United States does not at present have the capacity to export natural gas to Europe. We would have to convert existing facilities for importing LNG to exporting them. And right now, I think there may be one or two such facilities undergoing conversion. But then we would have to build many more of these facilities at a cost of several billion dollars each. And this would take many years for that to happen. So maybe 5 years from now, you could begin to export some amount of LNG, but to really make a difference, maybe 10 years. And let me add, this would require increased production of gas in the United States to meet domestic needs for increased gas and to satisfy increased demands in Europe. And this would require more fracking. That's where this gas is coming from. It's from fracking of shale formations in Pennsylvania, in New York State, eventually, in Texas and Louisiana, Arkansas. And I'm not sure that the public is going to tolerate that much of an increase in fracking to make this possible.
Well, some of Europe already gets its natural gas from Africa, and of course Qatar is a huge exporter, and the Ukrainians are talking about building a port on the Black Sea, so that's not a big reach. And Germany is the biggest customer for Gazprom, Russian gas, followed by Ukraine, and then Turkey, Belarus, Italy, Poland, Britain, Czech Republic, France, and Hungary. So, you know, the countries that are on the Mediterranean, certainly Turkey and Italy would be customers, and presumably Britain and eventually the rest of, and France and the rest of Europe. But as you're saying, it takes time. Now, give us a, well, let me again remind the audience, if I may, that I'm speaking with Michael Clare, the Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College, and the author of Blood and Oil and The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. He has an article at The Nation, Petromachismo. Now, let's talk about petromachismo in the context of this discussion, Michael. It's clear that the fracking boom in the United States has turned things around enormously in terms of the energy, global energy profile. The U.S. is now the world's largest exporter, eclipsing Russia. So you're arguing then this is having a geopolitical implication, right? And this is giving President Obama petromachismo?
Exactly right. And you can see this expressed openly by the president's former national security advisor while he was still working for Obama, Tom Donilon. In a speech last April at Columbia University, he said that the natural gas revolution and the increase in oil production through fracking has given the United States a new geopolitical leverage. Why? Because we're less dependent on Middle Eastern oil, so we're no longer beholden to Middle Eastern petrostates, and we can get more of our oil from Canada from the Keystone XL pipeline when it's built, presumably. And in other ways, we're becoming independent of the way we once were on Middle Eastern and African oil. This gives us a freer hand. At the same time, China is becoming more dependent on imported oil from the Middle East. So this gives us a geostrategic advantage. And I think this is the underpinning of the pivot strategy, where the U.S. is switching its pressure, its deployment of forces from the Middle East where we no longer needed to defend our supply of oil, to the Pacific to put pressure on China. And China has responded by drawing closer to Russia. And I think this has emboldened Russia. So there's been this kind of chain reaction of events. But it begins, or in part it begins anyway, with the shale gas revolution and the production of oil from shale, giving the United States a new lift in it, or at least that's the way they view it, and in foreign affairs. And this is what I call petromachismo.
Well, of course, the best laid plans, we may be pivoting to Asia, but we're still stuck in the Middle East, not knowing what to do about Syria. And now this whole situation in Ukraine is blowing up and looking like, at least rhetorically, a return to the Cold War, at least a standoff. We know that Russia appears to be going to annex Crimea, which is a part of Ukraine, and this will probably lead to sanctions. And that's my sense, is that as soon as you start throwing sanctions around, then the Russians can retaliate. But again, I'm not sure how retaliating by cutting off its main source of cash from Europe, the Russians will be winning that game. And as you pointed out, the counter strategy of resupplying the EU with American and other gas supplies from other parts of the world is like 4 or 5 years off. So walk us through the possible scenarios that are likely to follow from these ratcheting up of sanctions against Russia and counter sanctions, whatever Putin decides, however Putin decides to retaliate.
Yes, of course, there are many people who like to know the answer to that. My suspicion is that you will see a splintering of Europe over this issue because, as you said earlier, Ian, Germany is the biggest customer for natural gas from Russia. And what they've done is to bypass Ukraine entirely by building a pipeline that goes directly to Russia under the Baltic Sea. So the Nord Stream pipeline, this has just opened up, and it's a response to the stuff that's gone on in the Ukraine in the past, where which you talked about, where Russia cut off gas to Ukraine, and the Ukrainians then took all that gas that was supposed to go to Europe, therefore damaging Germany. So what did they do? They built a pipeline directly to Russia. So Germany is not affected by all of this. And it seems pretty clear to me that Germany is not going to impose tough sanctions on Russia as long as they go no further than Crimea, let me put it that way. And Putin has a vested interest. They're codependent. The main source of income for the Russian state is its gas exports. So I think you're going to find some kind of modus operandi where Europe agrees to Russian protectorate over the Crimea, and Russia stays out of eastern Ukraine, and things go back more or less to where they were. Europe splits. Something like that.
So in terms of the U.S., though, having any kind of leverage by being able to resupply,
There's no leverage there. The U.S. is not in a position at this point in time or for the next 5 to 10 years to really resupply Europe. This is a fantasy.
Well, but that doesn't mean that the oil companies aren't applying for applications to build LNG facilities to export natural gas.
This has nothing to do with geopolitics. This has to do with profit. That because now they can't export the gas, there's a lot of gas in the U.S., so prices have dropped, which has been great for American consumers and utilities. Electric costs have dropped, and manufacturers in the U.S., like Alcoa, have been able to get gas at a lower price. And the oil and gas companies want to export their gas so they could sell it at the international rate, which is 2, 3, 4 times greater than it is in the U.S. This has nothing to do with Russia.
Right, but it could. If these LNG terminals are approved, it could.
Sure, but then this will be a free market, and whether that LNG is exported to Europe or to China, more likely, or Japan, it will be up to market forces, not to geopolitics. But you're right, that some of it will go to Europe.
So what's your sense then, Michael Clare, of what this particular petromachismo weapon that Obama has? I mean, where is it in his terms of his holster as a kind of gunslinger? You know, I'm trying to get that, trying to get to the nitty-gritty here.
I think it's a psychological boost. As Tom Donilon, the former National Security Advisor, says, it gives the U.S. more confidence to throw its weight around in international affairs. You see that with the dealings with Iran, in the sense that the U.S. can agree to negotiations, but also could agree to go to war with Iran without worrying about Iran shutting off the Strait of Hormuz and bringing the world economy to a halt, which it threatens to do all of the time, because we're not dependent anymore on Iranian or Middle Eastern oil. So it gives us a freer hand in Iranian politics, and I think it gives us Washington, a freer hand in putting pressure on China in the Pacific. And I think it gives the U.S. the fantasy of putting pressure on Russia. I say fantasy because it's going to produce a backlash.
Well, clearly, though, what's happened now has created a backlash. I mean, they're talking tough, everybody.
Yes,
is. You know,
yes.
So at some point or other, they're going to have to walk the walk, aren't they?
Well, absolutely, and that's what this talk about LNG is, and this is a new expression of that. Mm-hmm. And I think there will be tremendous pressure on Obama to. He had been going slow on this because this will have a negative effect on domestic interests. But I think now he's going to go full steam ahead to increase LNG exports on the basis that this will help Europe. But what I'm saying is this will not have an immediate effect.
Well, it's not often mentioned, but, you know, Putin's dissertation when he was at the Leningrad College of Minerals and Mining and Geology, I can't remember the exact title of where he got his degree, but his thesis was on how the USSR can use energy as a geopolitical weapon and control the pipelines, which they have done. I mean, they're all, you know, they all go to Moscow in effect from the south, and you know, it's hard to not believe that the Chechen war and other activities in the Caucasus have had more to do with denying any of the post-Soviet states having the ability to transit directly to the Mediterranean export. And so there's no question that Putin knows more about oil, gas, and pipelines than just about anybody on the planet.
You were so right about this. I wrote about that in my books about energy. The situation is changing a bit for Putin because of the shale gas revolution. His situation has deteriorated, and that's because his existing oil and gas fields are in decline, and there's a lot more undeveloped oil and gas in Russia, but it's all in the Arctic, and it's going to be in Siberia and the Arctic, and it's going to be very costly to produce, very costly, very difficult, very challenging. And to begin with, Gazprom lacks the technology to do that, so he's being forced to cut deals with ExxonMobil to go up there, mm-hmm. Number one. And number two, fracking is cheaper. It's a cheaper way to produce energy, and this is encouraging Europeans to start fracking and encouraging all these ideas of LNG imports from around the world that we're talking about.
Sure. Well, Michael Clare, just in closing, will, though, this eventually push Russia, you know, a few years down the pipeline, if you will? Will this push Russia more towards China, and will China become the replacement market for Russian oil and gas after Europe gets its independence, assuming it heads that way?
I think you hit the nail on the head. In fact, I heard in person, I heard Putin say this. The EU has brought an antitrust case against Gazprom for anti-competitive behavior in Europe. And in response to a question at a press conference I attended, he said that, well, we don't think this will go anywhere, but if it does, we're going to respond by shifting more and more of our exports to Asia, to China and Japan. So you're quite right. That is his plan B.
Well, Michael Clare, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, as always.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Clare, who's a Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His books include Blood and Oil and The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources, and he has an article at The Nation, Petromachismo. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the ramifications of the upcoming referendum in Crimea.
Energy is becoming one of our country's greatest concerns.
Hey, rejuvenation. The second wind. When will it begin? Repatriation. What is my sin? When will my ship come in?
First I... Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Quigley, who's a professor emeritus of law at Ohio State University and previously a research scholar at Moscow State University and a research associate in comparative law at Harvard Law School. He has dealt with conflicts between Ukraine and Russia after the breakup of the USSR on behalf of the Organization for the Security and Cooperation in Europe. And his books include Basic Laws on the Structure of the Soviet State, Law After Revolution, and The Ruses of War, American Intervention Since World War II. He has an article at the Cambridge Journal for International and Comparative Law, Finding a Way Forward for Crimea. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Quigley.
Thank you very much.
And clearly with the impending vote in the Crimean Parliament, which is very pro-Russian, this would seem on the face of it, and it's certainly been the reaction from the West, that it's illegal. I mean, Crimea is, after all, a part of Ukraine. So how do you get out of this bind?
Well, the question of the status of a territory and its affiliation isn't limited to the law of the state in which, you know, that territory finds itself. When the Albanians in Kosovo wanted to secede from Serbia, no, that was not lawful under the law of Serbia, but NATO went and bombed Serbia to ensure that they would be able to separate. So the Prime Minister of Ukraine is certainly saying that this is unlawful under the Ukrainian constitution, and that's probably correct, but that's not the end of the story. You do have the concept of self-determination, and if you have the population of Crimea voting, as it likely will, to secede from Ukraine, that makes it very difficult for the Western leaders to insist that they not do that, because at that point it's not Mr. Putin versus the West, it's the population of that territory.
Well, but the analogy you gave with Kosovo would indicate that that NATO bombed Serbia out of the picture and thus changed the rules, and in this case, Russia sent its special forces in and changed the rules. I mean, neither case is a particularly savory one, is it?
Well, you're right. In both instances, there was use of force. I think it was probably more destructive in the Serbia case. I mean, there were people killed by the bombing. It was a major bombing campaign that went on for some time. But the basic issue is whether a population that wants to secede from wherever it is, has the rights to do that. And that isn't solely a question of domestic law.
Yeah, but this is not a question of the people spontaneously in Crimea, spontaneously waking up one morning and deciding they want to leave Ukraine and join Russia. There was a military, I don't know whether you could call it an invasion, because they have a substantial force on the ground, but there's no question that Russia moved militarily to annex this territory, and they are basically acting as though this is a de facto situation. And even though the tensions between the Russians and the Ukrainian soldiers seem to be subsiding a little, it's a fait accompli, isn't it?
Well, it is, in that sense, yes, the case that the Russian military is occupying, which means that that there is a possibility of factual separation from Ukraine. But the sentiment in the territory, the sentiment in Crimea, has been very steady for a long time. When I was there, as you were mentioning, I was there on behalf of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in 1994. And the Crimean parliament people were saying to me then the same thing that they're saying today, namely that they do not want to be part of Ukraine and they would like to find a way to affiliate with Russia. So this is a longstanding sentiment that predates the recent military activity.
Again, I'm speaking with John Quigley, who's a professor emeritus of law at Ohio State University and previously a research scholar at Moscow State University. He also has dealt with conflicts between Ukraine and Russia after the breakup of the USSR on behalf of the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe. And his books include Basic Laws on the Structure of the Soviet State, Law After Revolution, and Ruses of War, American Intervention Since World War II, and he has an article at the Cambridge Journal on International Comparative Law, Finding a Way Forward for Crimea. But when you were there for the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe in 1994, that was when the Budapest Agreement was signed between the United States, the UK, Russia, and Ukraine, guaranteeing Ukrainian sovereignty over Crimea and what is the rest of Ukraine. And that was in exchange for removing nuclear weapons, wasn't it?
Yes, that was an agreement. There is some question about the character of that agreement, whether it's an actual treaty, an obligation kind of document, or whether it's more a statement. The United States, actually, in referring to the Budapest agreement, does not put it in the category of treaty. But that said, it does say that the parties, including Russia, will respect the territorial integrity of Ukraine. It doesn't specify Crimea, but that was implied. But here you have a situation where the population of this piece of territory, which after all was Russian since the 18th century, where the population says it wants to secede from Ukraine. So it seems to me that it takes it out of the Budapest Agreement.
So what is then the way forward that you're offering, John Quigley?
Well, I'm not sure what the way forward is. Back in 1994, the Russian government was not willing to go to the length of saying that they would take Crimea. Now it appears that might occur. There's been activity in the Duma in Moscow just within the last 24 hours in the direction of legislation that might facilitate this. Mr. Putin hasn't said yay or nay on the matter, so it could be that this will happen. Short of that, it seems to me that there should be some firm guarantees for autonomy for Crimea within Ukraine if it doesn't work out that there will be a separation. There also seems to me there need to be some guarantees for the Tatar population in Crimea, which is a minority. It's the indigenous population from which the Russians actually took the place over back in the 18th century. And they are not happy about the possibility of affiliation with Russia. They will likely boycott the referendum vote when it occurs on, I think, now scheduled for March 16. I've had contact with them as well. They have a little parliamentary assembly of their own that they call a majlis. And they would need to have some assurance that they would be protected if Crimea becomes part of Russia.
Well, they have a pretty unfortunate history, do they not, the Tatars? I mean, when Hitler invaded, they were persecuted, and then when Stalin retook the territory, he decided that they were all traitors and moved them off into the middle of nowhere, where many or most of them died, and then they were eventually repatriated, and they make up to 15% of the population, and they are clearly not particularly, they're certainly not pro-Soviet, and I'm not sure how pro-Russian they are.
Yes, I think they're definitely not pro-Russian. They have been much friendlier to the Ukraine government. It's the Ukraine government that has facilitated their repatriation into Crimea. The history, as you recited it, is quite accurate and not very pleasant. And that didn't do anything to make the Tatars appreciate the Russians anymore.
So, I mean, this is obviously not the way to do business, is it? My understanding, I spoke with a reporter in Crimea yesterday whose hotel was surrounded by Russian thugs who were screaming all kinds of racist epithets against Obama and harassing UN and foreign UN officials and foreign journalists. So the tensions are pretty high, and you've got soldiers facing each other across the Crimean-Ukrainian border, apparently. My sense is that, you know, this is pretty reckless brinksmanship. You know, this is almost like the guns of August. You know, somebody could firing the wrong shot, and it could really turn ugly.
That's certainly possible, and a great danger in the situation. And it is unfortunate that the group from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe was not allowed in, as apparently just within the last 24 hours they tried to enter. They're being put there largely, I think, at the request of the United States, and their aim is to monitor. I would hope that they might be able to play a role beyond monitoring in order to help facilitate some communication among the different groups, among in particular to deal with the Majlis of the Tatars, and perhaps help to bring about some a reconciliation, I mean, not only in Crimea, but in the rest of Ukraine as well.
Well, my understanding is that Putin largely did this on the advice of his generals, not on the advice of his diplomats or the oligarchs. And so he took the military imperative over other economic and diplomatic considerations, because his generals were saying to him, this new government in Ukraine is not on our side, and you're going to end up with NATO right on the Crimean border, and we don't know how long the base agreements, the lease is going to be honored, so we got to go in there and grab this territory. That's my understanding of what happened.
I think that's essentially accurate, that there is concern that the base agreement will be nullified on the Ukrainian side. There was also the law that was adopted by the Ukraine parliament to revoke the prior law that had provided for minority languages being official languages in sectors of
Ukraine.
Right,
but that was subsequently rescinded.
It was subsequently rescinded, but it did happen, and it was during the time before it was rescinded that you found the Russian action commencing. So there is concern on the part of the Russian speakers, and they're looking to Mr. Putin for some kind of support.
So is there, I've asked you this question before, is there a way out? What I see happening now, the positions hardening and the U.S. and Europe now talking about sanctions, revoking visas. We could get into a situation fairly soon where Putin may reciprocate by turning off the natural gas tap. Although that, of course, will affect his revenues from Europe, but it will certainly impact Ukraine. Putin's already suggested that the Ukrainians are going to have to pay more for gas, and we know that they're bankrupt because the Yanukovych regime looted the treasury. So what's your sense of the direction things are heading?
You know, I don't have a good sense of the direction. If you're asking me to predict where things will actually go, I don't expect that that Russia will back down on this readily. So we might get into a situation where Crimea does separate and where sanctions are put in place, and we're just going to have a standoff for a period of time. The sanctions so far are fortunately the kinds of sanctions that can be revoked on short notice, and I think Mr. Obama has indicated that. So there is room for some movement there, but I'm not sure what Mr. Putin is likely to do that will lead Mr. Obama to want to lighten the sanctions.
And we don't haven't heard anything yet about what's come out of Paris, where the foreign ministers are meeting, the Russian, the French, the British, and American. So the one thing that I've seen is that the U.S. Or NATO is sending six F-15 fighter jets to Lithuania. I wonder what the hell that's going to do.
Yes. I don't know how that's going to change anybody's calculation.
So what would change people's calculation, do you think?
Well, I mean, if some really serious move were taken by the West, but that really isn't in the cards. There's certainly nothing militarily. The Europeans don't want to take any significant anti-Russia action in the economic front, which leaves the United States as the only one that might do that. But that wouldn't be very effective if it's only the United States. So I think, you know, Mr. Obama is really between a rock and a hard place.
And how much is Putin between a rock and a hard place? Because if I've been told that if Russians spill Ukrainian blood, that will backfire and blow up in his face, because this military incursion, which has so far been limited to Crimea, is not popular back home in Russia. And it would become very quickly unpopular if it turned sour.
I think that's right. I think he would be in some difficulty if he winds up taking action, or if action happens spontaneously or accidentally. I think he's tried to be rather cautious in that regard so far, but you're right, it could blow up.
So I guess I'm sort of flaying about here, John Quigley, trying to figure out, you know, how we can, you know, in the short term, avoid a horrible tragedy, even though it looks like Putin's made a power play, and so far he's winning, I guess, but it could turn, as we just mentioned, it could blow up in his face. But, you know, there's a sort of predictable Cold War kind of dynamic setting in here, which I find incredibly depressing. You know, during the Cold War, our punishment to Russia was to isolate them and not talk to them, and we seem to be repeating that. So that is not a useful dynamic.
No, it isn't. And it's more difficult now because we're not any longer in the Cold War situation. There's much more connection between Russia and the West.
Well, just in closing then, John Quigley, is there anybody that you can identify to our audience that you think is making any sense on the international stage that could step in here and, you know, give some adult supervision?
Well, the chair of the OSCE, who also happens to be the foreign minister of Switzerland, has been saying some rather cautious but rather good things. That is, he would like to get more involved, I think, in bringing the parties together. Whether that you know can be effective, I don't know. But if you're looking for a sane voice in the situation, that might be one.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, John Quigley.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with John Quigley, who's a professor emeritus of law at Ohio State University and previously a research scholar at Moscow State University and a research associate in comparative law at Harvard Law School. He has dealt with conflicts between Ukraine and Russia after the breakup of the USSR on behalf of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, and his books include Basic Laws on the Structures of the Soviet State, Law After Revolution, and The Ruses of War, American Intervention Since World War II. He has an article at the Cambridge Journal of International and Comparative Law, Finding a Way Forward for Crimea. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the shameful vote in the U.S. Senate that scuttled Obama's nominee for the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Will Bunch, who is an award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, and he blogs at Attitude, that's ATTYTWOD.com. He is the author of Tear Down This Myth, The Right-Wing Distortion of the Reagan Legacy and The Backlash, Right-Wing Radicals, High-Def Hucksters, and Paranoid Politics in the Age of Obama. And he has an article at Philly.com, Senator Bob Casey Needs a Feck Transplant. Welcome to Background Briefing, Will Bunch.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
And I take it you're suggesting that your Senator, Bob Casey, the Democrat, who along with, I think, six other Democrats, voted to torpedo the nomination of Debo Adegbole for the civil rights post in the Justice Department. He was also joined by, of course, the Republican Senator. What's going on in Philadelphia? Is it the Fraternal Order of Police that leaned on these guys? And how did they make this argument, which is essentially a red herring? Because, you know, as far as we know, going back to John Adams in the American Revolution, a lawyer's job is to defend his client. That's sacrosanct. So you don't punish people for doing their job.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the reason I wrote the piece, you know, we seem to be hearing this word all the time, feckless, you know, that people say President Obama's foreign policy is feckless or whatever. And I couldn't think of anything more feckless than the vote by these Democrats to side with Republicans. I mean, quickly, there's two things going on here. One, you mentioned the big picture. You know, we have a cherished tradition in this country that every accused person, no matter how horrible the crime they're accused of, is entitled to a defense, and they're entitled to an appeal. Justice John Roberts, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, defended an individual who was convicted of or handled the appeal of an individual convicted of, I think, seven or eight murders at one point in his career. Abraham Lincoln defended a murderer, you know. I think we're setting a very dangerous standard here if we're using that to disqualify highly qualified candidates for a job in the Justice Department. So that's number one. The other thing that you alluded to is the local politics. The case that's involved here is that Mr. Adegbole, when he was with the NAACP, got involved in the appeal of the death penalty for Mumia Abu-Jamal. It's a celebrated case here in Philadelphia, who about 30 years ago was convicted of murdering a Philadelphia police officer. And what's happened over the 30 years is because Mr. Abu-Jamal is he's very well-spoken, he's very photogenic, you know, he's written books from death row, and he's become this kind of international cause celeb, both with some elements of the American left, not all of it, and certainly a lot of left wing people overseas have adopted his cause. And as a result, there's been kind of a backlash, and you have local elements here in Philadelphia, like the Fraternal Order of Police, the police union, which is very powerful politically, that basically has this kind of absolutism that, like, anybody who touches the Abu-Jamal case in any way trying to either, you know, help free Abu-Jamal from prison, which is unlikely to happen, or to get his death penalty overturned, which is what the NAACP worked on, is practically black, you know, all but like blacklisted at this point. And I mean, that's the kind of political pressure that was applied here. So, you know, we have a Democratic senator, Bob Casey, you know, was a very early and enthusiastic supporter of President Obama when he ran for president in 2008. Not the most liberal Democrat in the Senate by any means, but, you know, a fairly good vote on things. But he responded to this pressure from the FOP, the Fraternal Order of Police, and he came out last week and said he was going to oppose this nomination, and that seemed to turn the tide. That kind of gave the okay for other Democrats who were in more conservative, mostly white, red states, people like Joe Manchin from West Virginia, Senator Walsh from Montana. These type people sided. Even Chris Coons, who's a very liberal most of the time, Senator from Delaware, sided with Senator Casey. And, you know, I was appalled that Senator Casey would go against this long tradition of, you know, not judging attorneys based on their clients. and do that in this case just because of the political pressure from the FOP.
And of course, Will Bunch, Debo Adegbole, he who was the former director and counsel of the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund, he inherited this appeal for Mumia Abu-Jamal. It wasn't exactly on his initiative, but the principle, of course, has been violated. But that's why I was talking to you, because I figured this, the roots of this shameful action on the part of the Senate seemed to be in Pennsylvania.
Right. If you're from outside of Pennsylvania, I mean, the politics of this might be a little bit bewildering, but because it is a 30-year-old case, but the passions are so raw, it's almost like it happened last week. You know, I think over time, I mean, first you saw a movement on the left, you know, to free Mumia. I'm sure some of your listeners have heard that slogan before. In fact, I actually attended a Free Mumia protest in Los Angeles when I was there for the 2000 Democratic Convention. So this has been a cause on the left. What happened is, like I said, there's been a backlash, you know, certain conservative elements, and certainly any police and police union and people who are anxious to portray themselves as zealous protectors of law enforcement have made fighting the Free Mumia movement their cause, you know, and it's a very passionate thing after 30 years. I mean, you know, like most Philadelphians, I followed this case very closely. You know, I happen to think there's very little doubt that Abu-Jamal was the killer of police officer Danny Faulkner, and you know, I don't think he should be freed. And you know, a lot of liberal people in Philadelphia who actually know the facts of the case feel the same way. On the other hand, I mean, there's a whole separate issue here with the death penalty. I mean, just because you think that he's guilty of murder, you know, 40% of Americans oppose the death penalty. I mean, it's a pretty it may not be a majority yet, but it's a pretty strong group. And this is what the NAACP was fighting for in this case, to have the death penalty overturned. I think it is a totally valid argument that there was racial disparities in the way the jury was selected. As you know, the jury decides whether a person in a first-degree murder case gets the death penalty or gets life in prison. And this is what the NAACP and Mr. Adegbole were arguing, that the death penalty in this case was unfair because of these racial disparities. They weren't saying that he was innocent, or they weren't saying that he did not murder this police officer. And yet, on that flimsy standard, we had a group of Democratic senators who chickened out, basically, in my opinion.
Again, I'm speaking with Will Bunch, who is an award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, and he blogs at attitude.com. He is the author of Tear Down This Myth, The Right-Wing Distortion of the Reagan Legacy, and The Backlash, Right-Wing Radicals, High-Def Hucksters, and Paranoid Politics in the Age of Obama. And he has an article at philly.com, Senator Bob Casey Needs a Feck Transplant. And I've actually done, you know, as a journalist, I've looked into that case and talked to various crime reporters in Philadelphia and people in lawyers, et cetera, people that followed that case, which, of course, it's associated with the MOVE cult that was bombed by the Philadelphia police in a botched siege, which turned into a conflagration where these people were burned alive along with their children. And it was a horrible situation. Mumia was apparently deeply involved with this group and identified very much with them. And when this happened, he apparently went off the deep end. And there's not much doubt in my mind that he did shoot Officer Faulkner. Just as a journalist, I've looked into it. And I've always been mystified why he's become a cause celeb. And almost all my colleagues at Pacifica think he walks on water. And it's just mystifying. And of course, the European left have taken up this cause. And
yeah, well, you know, there's a street, I believe there's a street in Paris named for Mumia Abu-Jamal. And it is a fascinating thing. And it you know, it seems like the more miles geographically apart you are from Philadelphia, the more likely you are to believe in his innocence and want to see him freed. You know, I think, look, a lot of people are horrified by the death penalty and by death row culture in America. And I understand that. I certainly am to a strong degree. And I think, unfortunately, like I said, I think because, you know, he's a former journalist who writes well and gives very good interviews. You know, he's a handsome man. He's somebody who looks like he should be, you know, a poster child for opposing the death penalty. Unfortunately, I mean, to me, it bothers me that his case distracts from so many other cases of people who are on death row who, in some cases, are certainly innocent. In other cases, are on death row despite either mental illness or they were, you know, kind of a low-level accomplice to a crime or that sort of thing. I mean, there's so much injustice with the way that the death penalty is administered in this country, and it doesn't seem right that Mumia Abu-Jamal is a poster person for so many people for that movement, because he was found wounded by the police officer's gun with the gun that was used to kill the police officer right next to him. His advocates have had 30 years to present an alternate scenario in which he wasn't the killer, and that hasn't happened. So I do think that's unfortunate. But the bottom line is, it's tragic to see somebody who is such a great candidate for the post of civil rights chief at the Justice Department, like Debo Agdebili was, to see that nomination shot down as it was for these reasons. I mean, it was completely unfair. This is a person who started life in poverty, experienced homelessness, a child of immigrants who worked his way through law school. It really was the American dream up until this point, you know.
Well, that is the real story. It's not a question of the guilt or innocence of Mumia Abu-Jamal, even though, as you point out, there are an awful lot of African-American men in particular and boys in prison in this country unjustly, and who the justice system has denied. They're being warehoused. There have been some very eloquent books written about it, and it's a national shame. But, you know, this is adding to that national shame. I mean, in other words, there's an awful lot of African-Americans in prison who we should be championing. And I wish that Abu-Jamal would eventually own up to it and stop taking advantage of all of these, well-meaning progressives around the world. But that's not likely to happen.
No, I don't think at this point.
But in terms of Debo Adegbole, that is so despicable what they've just done, and that even made more so by what you just told us about his extraordinary background. This is somebody that we should be celebrating, not scapegoating.
Right, and we're talking about the racial disparity of the death penalty. I mean, certainly there's concerns about, I think, the racial aspects of this vote in the Senate. Whether a white candidate for a high level position would be who had advocated for a white alleged murder would be treated in the same way. I mean, as we said, look at the case of Justice Roberts. His past advocacy for a convicted murderer was not an issue at all in his confirmation. So, I the whole thing, like you said, is very troubling.
Well, but I think Senator Tom Harkin put it, I think, accurately, in a way that really challenges the whole Republican Party and these feckless Democrats. Mm-hmm. He's saying that this would not have happened if Debo Adegbole had been a white man.
Right. You can't prove that, but you certainly have to wonder, the facts on the ground here are you have an African-American advocating that an African-American not get the death penalty, and you had Republicans standing with a united front against them, and you had these seven Democrats, who sold out President Obama and their party and crossed over and voted against them. And like I said, it's hard to prove a negative. I mean, you can't prove that race was the main factor, but I think you have to be concerned and you have to be troubled on that front.
So since this whole story really comes out of Philadelphia and out of Pennsylvania, and this shameful act of the new U.S. Senate has its roots in the two senators from Pennsylvania, Bob Casey and Pat Toomey, the Republican, then what is the is there any sort of reckoning going on there? I mean, you mentioned that most people in Philadelphia accept the fact that Mumia Abu-Jamal is guilty, and that there's no point in trying to re-adjudicate that. It's the rest of the world that doesn't seem to have looked into the case very thoroughly. But in terms of the real issue here, which is this shameful act on the part of the Senate, what is the local sentiment?
I think the community has been very divided among the lines that you would expect. You know that conservative white suburbanites, think that the Mumia case is toxic, and that anybody who's touched it in any way that appears to be pro Mumia is like I said, blacklisted basically. And then obviously you have, you know, certain elements on the left, either on the farther fringes, people who think the Mumia should be freed, or at least other people, I think, kind of the more center left, who oppose the death penalty and certainly are not happy with Senator Casey's vote. I think one reason why this happened is I think that there probably wasn't much downside for Bob Casey politically to vote for this. After being elected to two terms, it's very unlikely that he's going to be challenged from his left. And plus, he's not up for re-election until 2018. And, you know, God only knows what the issues are going to be 4.5 years from now. But, frankly, given the fact that he doesn't have to face the voters for 4.5 years, I'm a little surprised that, he wouldn't help President Obama get this through, on the other hand, and not be so worried about what the Fraternal Order of Police thinks of him. But that's not the way he went in this case.
Well, Will Bunch, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Ian. I appreciate it. Anytime.
Again, I've been speaking with Will Bunch, who's an award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, and he blogs at Attitude, that's ATTYTOOD.com. He is the author of Tear Down This Myth, The Right-Wing Distortion of the Reagan Legacy, and The Backlash, Right-Wing Radicals, High-Def Hucksters, and Paranoid Politics in the Age of Obama. And he has an article at Philly.com, Senator Bob Casey Needs a Feck Transplant. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.